Okay, ladies and gentlemen, if I could have your attention for a short minute. Welcome to McGill. Welcome to Homecoming. My name is Alex Jippa. I'm a McGill Engineering graduate, 1988. I'm also on the alumni board of directors. I have the privilege for this year's Homecoming of being titled Homecoming Chair. A lot of people call me Homecoming Queen, but let's just call Homecoming Chair for now. Sounds a little bit better. So as you may have figured out by now, and those of you who are Homecoming veterans, Homecoming is a really big deal. It's a very big event on the alumni community calendar. There's a lot of things going on. There's luncheons, there's reunion dinners, there's a Leacock lunch. Now it's out in the open. We had a big, big event at McGill. President Bill Clinton was given an honorary doctorate yesterday, or maybe perhaps some of you had the privilege of being there. It was quite the special event. Leacock luncheon, reunion dinners, these lecture series called Quacks, Classes Without Quizzes. There's a reception I'll speak about later at 5:30. Tomorrow morning, there is a walking tour of Old Montreal. There's a brunch at the Athletic Association on Pierce Street. And there's also a whole bunch of parallel activities, which we call Parents Weekend. And this is a relatively new initiative. It's been going on for about 2 or 3 years. But I think it's a brilliant idea. And what we do is basically open a hand to welcome parents to be a part of the McGill community, you know, and I think it's a lot of fun. Just for fun, how many McGill parents are here? There you go, more than half, right? So that's it. Well, thank you very much for coming. And again, I think it's really fun to have you as part of the McGill community. So these lecture series, Quacks, Classes Without Quizzes, they're one of the highlights of Homecoming. And as you may have seen in the program, they're about anything and everything. We have some more science, politics, health sciences. I'm a big fan of architecture, so I have the privilege of talking about this one here. Now, they say something here which I have the privilege of disagreeing with. I quote, "There aren't any papers or exams. All that's required of you is that you sit back and enjoy an interesting and informative presentation. However, it is up to the discretion of the MAA host, based on the behavior of the crowd, if you're going to get a snap quiz or not at the end." Actually, no, that is a joke. More than 20 years after graduating from McGill, I admit I still occasionally get anxiety nightmares, so I'm not going to do any more stuff like that. I'll talk a little bit about our speaker, Professor Anne-Marie Adams, who is going to give us a lecture entitled, "What is Postmodern Architecture?" So Professor Adams is the Associate Director of Post-Professional Programs and the William C. McDonald Professor at McGill School of Architecture. Her early work included participation in the restructuring of the Alaska Highway, a task she took on just after graduating with an honors BA from McGill. While after that, after bolstering her resume with a master's and a PhD from University of California, Berkeley, she returned home to McGill to design a place for herself in the School of Architecture. Apparently, she brought blueprints with her because in no time she had built herself into one of architecture's most engaging and popular professors. Now, I remember back in my day in engineering that we were always jealous of the architects because they got to walk around with these really cool plastic black tubes in the metro around campus, and us engineering nerds, all we had was like a briefcase. So I always wanted to be an architect, but it's all good. Professor Adams is an expert on the history of domestic architecture, hospital design, and gendered space. She travels frequently and widely to lecture to university audiences and community groups. These interests have brought about such fascinating courses as, of course, I guess she teaches perhaps here at McGill, Sex and the Single Building, the 20th Century Architectural Seminar on Gender, Sexuality, and Space, and also numerous articles published in journals and magazines and several books. Some of these include Architecture in the Family Way, Doctors, Houses, and Women, 1870 to 1900, Designing Women, Gender, and the Architectural Profession, and a book last year, Medicine by Design, The Architect and the Modern Hospital, 1893 to 1943. On top of that, Professor Adams is also a mentor at the University of Toronto-based program called Health, Care, Technology, and Place. This is funded by the Canadian Institutes of Health Research. She holds research funds from the Canadian Institutes of Health Research, the HANA Institute for the History of Medicine, Heritage Canada, and the Australian Research Council. She is also a member of the Royal Architectural Institute of Canada. So that's quite a pedigree. Please join me in welcoming distinguished architect, scholar, and thinker, Professor Anne-Marie Adams.
Well, thank you very much, Alex, for that very nice introduction. Can you hear me without a mic? Yes, okay. And thank you, everybody, for coming today. I'm so honored to be asked to do a quack, as we say at McGill. And what I've decided to do is take an undergraduate lecture from my class, Architecture Architecture 355, which is also called Architecture Since World War II. It's quite a popular class, and students from across the campus take it. And I think of it as a kind of crash course in 20th century architectural history. So I put together a few ideas from different lectures. I hope it'll all make sense in the next 45 minutes or so. And my goal today is for you to leave the room with a list of characteristics so you can recognize a postmodern building. And it's not that easy to do because I guess if this lecture has an argument, is that postmodernism isn't an aesthetic, isn't a set of formal characteristics, particular shapes or forms, but really it's something you detect in the attitude of buildings. So you've got to get inside them and touch them and smell them, and that's how you figure out what postmodernism is. I should also say that the methodology behind this lecture is nothing more than simple observation. The images are almost exclusively my own. Many of them are taken on my cell phone when I just see things that interest me. And you'll see McGill architecture students in many of them because I am really a big believer in getting students out to see architecture rather than sitting in a windowless classroom like we are today. So I hope you will. Yeah, this is not postmodernism. The diversity of places that I'll blast you with today, it'll be about a slide a minute, I guess, and the students say I go so fast with the slides that it's pretty close to television, and that's what I'll try to do for you today. So, to try and, as you see, the key word is missing on my original Charles Jenks book, too, on the book cover. It's very hard to define postmodernism. Remarkably, though, it was used first to describe architecture before it was used for art or music or literary criticism. And this is nice for we architects because we usually feel like we're behind in things rather than ahead of the ball. So the term postmodernism was actually coined with this book, The Language of Postmodernism, in 1977. And then it just took off. It was coined by Charles Jenks. As you can see, he's an American who teaches at the AA, the Architectural Association, in London. And he wrote a series of books in the late 1970s where he developed this idea of postmodernism. And of course, postmodernism, the word, means nothing more than after modernism. So to justify it being after modernism, Jenks actually pinpointed the death of modernism. He killed modernism in his book. And he pinpointed at this exact moment, 3 p.m., March 16, 1972, with the demolition of the social housing project called Pruitt-Igoe in St. Louis, Missouri. So he claims when this building, this horrible vertical ghetto, was blown up in St. Louis, that was the beginning of postmodernism. Now, my own opinion is that the historic preservation movement also that was getting going simultaneously really nourished postmodernism too, and that with some distance we've got to try and understand the goals of the two movements together. And just to refresh your memory, in the United States they passed the Historic Preservation Act in 1966, so just a few years before Jenks coined the term. And this came about from the very sad demolition of Penn Station in New York in 1964. People were quite outraged. It became an organized movement. And also whole pieces of modern cities were being removed in what architectural historians have come to term the urban removal movement rather than urban renewal movement. So there were these great movements across North America to protect whole districts, not just individual buildings. And of course, Old Montreal is a great example of this. There were farmers markets, like our Atwater Market, preserved early on. Luckily, the decision was made at this time for the Ville Marie Expressway to go under Old Montreal, saving all those lovely buildings. And one of the early examples of reuse that I've chosen to show you here. It was designed by one of my teachers, Joe Escherich, or Escherich, Holmesy, Dodge, and Davis. It's the cannery in San Francisco. Maybe some of you have been there. It's an old fish cannery, and it's a very popular, you know, shopping place. And these places always sell frozen yogurt for some reason. Frozen yogurt and historic preservation go together. But anyway, so here it is. And at the same time, the lawyers were very busy making legislation to protect buildings. The protection of historic buildings in Canada is not as clear as it is in the United States. But places like Nantucket, shown here behind me, in Massachusetts, the island off Cape Cod, enacted legislation in 1972 that all new buildings had to look like the old buildings. Now, this has been disastrous in some regards, in that, you know, the high school and the airport kind of look like old fishermen's cottages. These extreme things happen from them. Of course, Westmount is another example here in Montreal of a neighborhood that really took action early to enforce new construction would look like old construction. And if you even want to change your railing today in Westmount, you have to make a very serious application. So I think what's important to take from all these examples is that postmodernism and the historic preservation movement came together to make places that were imagined, to suggest an imagined past. And, of course, architects were still busy doing modern buildings. This is the Pompidou Center in Paris, 1974 to 1977. It's exactly the same time as Jenks' book by Piano and Rogers, where I think we've come to understand it as a place that suggests that modernism was really reaching its limits, that modernism needed color and human scale and playfulness like this building has, and even humor. Humor is a huge part of postmodernism. The notion of the user's experience, that people should experience places in a personal way and emotionally and deeply, is also something we see rise to the surface in postmodernism and also in the historic preservation movement. And we see this in the changes in architectural education, too, that in the 1970s, schools of architecture in the United States, the major ones, the 11 major PhD programs, all instituted specialized options in things called like social factors, where students would study the interaction of humans and buildings. Remarkably, nobody had studied that before the 1970s. Now we have many students who study it. On the screen now is Maya Lin's famous Vietnam Memorial on the Mall in Washington, D.C., certainly one of the most important buildings, designs of the 20th century, extremely controversial. It's 1982, so a few years after all of this stuff with Jenks is getting going. But Maya Lin was a Yale student of architecture when she won the competition, and, of course, of Asian descent. And there was a big protest on the part of some veterans who wanted the old sculpture of the anonymous soldier rather than this long abstract wall with names on it. Still, Maya Lin's design was constructed, and it's extremely effective as a monument, and I would say has really changed the course of the way memorials are designed since then. It looked back at places like Williamsburg in Virginia, which had been built since the 1930s, and were all about imagining a place. You know, Williamsburg is like a living wax museum. But here it's very different because the user's experience... Sorry. Sure. Alex, where did Alex go? Yeah, certainly you can't see the names. Oh, well, let's see the wall again. Oh, I do have to? Okay, I thought I didn't have to. Sorry about that. So one of the things... Is this on?
Okay, one of the things that people really like about the Vietnam Memorial is that they can take something home from it. Are the lights better now? We can just turn them off, can't we? That's better. Thank you very much. Is that they can take something home from it. I bet many of you have been there and you've seen the thousands of names on the wall. What's really touching for users or for visitors is that you can, you know, find the person that you're looking for. You don't have to find them in the abstract soldier. But also you can do the rubbing. That's what you were saying. You can rub a piece of paper against the name and take that name home with you. And it's a very simple idea, but of course, simple ideas are often the best. And it's gotten me to thinking about how our whole attitude towards celebrity death, too, has changed in the so-called postmodern era since the late 1970s. And of course, the most exaggerated example is the reaction to the death of Lady Diana in August 1997, where this is an aerial view of the flowers that were left for her as news broke of her death. Yes. Oh, I always thought they were, but it has never occurred to me they weren't. Yes. Yeah. Well, it was a competition, a blind competition, so she did well in the competition. Yes. Well, architecture programs are tough.
Excuse me, just a quick little side note. There will be a question and answer period.
Okay. Anyway, so we see in this outpouring of grief and emotion and this urge to leave something for the dead celebrity, as if we knew Lady Diana. And we've seen this, you know, again and again since this time in the deaths of John Kennedy Jr. and most recently Michael Jackson, of course. But before this time, I think people celebrated celebrity death in a very, very different way and wouldn't dare to make that direct connection between their bodies and the place where it happened. Now we want to be there. We want to be part of it. We feel like we knew the person. And again, it's part of an imagined relationship that we don't really have, but we want to have. So we see this in, you know, fabulous historic preservation projects. This is Dolores Hayden's Power of Place in Los Angeles, which is really just a wall in a parking garage. And what Hayden and a bunch of artists did was celebrate the ethnic diversity of Los Angeles. So in this wall is the story of an African-American midwife's homestead. You can see her fence, and you can see the way she signed her name with an X, a Latina garment workers' union headquarters, a Japanese-American flower fields, all sorts of the history of invisible groups that were never, ever represented in monumental historic preservation projects. So I think what you, in looking back at these places, what we see is a real sense or an urge of to record what's been lost, which is a very, very powerful thing. And professional schools of architecture began expanding their history programs at exactly the same time. Remember, in the Bauhaus in the 1920s in Germany, the center of modern architectural education, the teaching of history was really forbidden. So it's really come full turn by this time. Now, this idea of making imaginary places and the magic of technology to fool people, of course, is inspired to a great extent by Hollywood and by the movies and the ability to recreate past expressions, including everyday life. So architects become very interested in this idea of imagined places and ordinary places. If there is a manifesto of postmodern architecture, this is it. Robert Venturi's 1966 book, Complexity and Contradiction in Architecture, was certainly required reading of architecture students in the 1970s and 1980s. And in this book, very controversial book, Venturi criticizes the purely functional and spare designs of modern Orthodox architecture, and he has been considered a counter-revolutionary for doing so. It's been described as a gentle manifesto. Really incredible that it was published in 1966. And described in the introduction by Vincent Scully, the Yale architectural historian, as probably the most important writing on the making of architecture since Le Corbusier's Towards a New Architecture of 1923. The book was translated and published at that time in 18 languages. It's a wonderful book. And Venturi wrote a second very important book with his wife, Denise Scott Brown, and his partner, Stephen Eisner, Learning from Las Vegas, in which he urged architects to embrace the ordinary and to look at what American streets had to offer. It's a study of the Las Vegas Strip that he undertook in 1968 at Yale, and of course was a further rebuke to Orthodox modernism and the elitism of much architectural taste. And what really, I mean, this was certainly required reading when I went to architecture school in the 1980s. And what came out of the, I guess what the most important idea that came out of Venturi's second book, Learning from Las Vegas, is that buildings could all be divided into these two types, ducks and decorated sheds. And the duck, of course, is a duck. The duck is like the orange julep here in Montreal. It expresses its function by its shape. It doesn't need a sign. The shape of it says what it is supposed to do. So I'm sure you've all been to restaurants shaped like avocados and, you know, wonderful, wonderful stuff that's often found beside highways because these shapes were so easy to see from the car. I should have said the decorated shed. Well, the decorated shed is like all the other buildings. I guess Walmart would be the great example of just a great big box and a parking lot and then the sign way up by the road that says, you know, decorated sheds. So it's fun to walk around downtown in a city like Montreal and see which buildings are ducks and which buildings are decorated sheds. And in this book, too, I guess besides this great diagram, Venturi says less is a bore as a response to Mies van der Rohe, the great purist modernist, who said less is more. So there is that sense, you know, that less is a bore and that architects need to add color and fun and irony and all sorts of things that we're missing from modern architecture. So I like to show students these two examples because they're kind of on the same theme of food, what a duck and a decorated shed are. And actually, Venturi uses this building in his book. It's the Tale of the Pup in Los Angeles. Maybe some of you have been there, because when you go there to buy your hot dog, you'll always find architecture students and architects photographing it because it's so famous from Venturi's book. Now, the hamburger hut Venturi has yet to discover. I just discovered it. And I thought it was a good example, even though you can't see the building because it's so far back, of a decorated shed in basically the same setting. So what Venturi really likes ducks. And he thinks that what American culture has given to world culture is the Las Vegas Strip and all the chaos and fun and, you know, dark stuff that come with it, too. So they're also very humorous buildings. And if you look at Venturi's own practice, it's a model in this regard. I hope I'm not blocking the slides for you. Venturi's work is hilarious. And you're looking at this building saying, well, what's so funny about that? That's not a remarkable building. That could be on Cavendish. You know, it's not. Well, this is the Guild House in Philadelphia by Robert Venturi. Oh, I don't have the date here. I think it's something like 1966. And it is a house for residents for senior citizens. And one of the things about postmodernism is that it's very subtle. And its humor comes from taking a second look. So what there are, and the architects in the crowd, if you haven't, you know, don't know it already, will think that it's rather a funny building because it's got this great big fat column that just holds up a bunch of windows, and then there's this huge flat arch at the top. But what is very famous about the building is the fact that Venturi uses a television antenna on the top of the facade to express what everybody inside is doing, which is watching television. He also uses these very subtle slits. I have my fancy laser pointer. These subtle slits right here to show people that there's really nothing behind the facade. And then, of course, this garish graphic sign, Guild House, over the entrance. And this, to him, is really a postmodern masterpiece. So you can see it's kind of private jokes and maybe some jokes that only architects would get. But in any case, there it is, as late in the 1960s. He designs lots of lovely buildings, too. Here and here are two little houses he designed in Nantucket. No coincidence, I think, that these things happen at the same place. So the Trubeck and Wislocki houses from 1972. It's for a two generations of the same family. Lovely little beach houses right on the water. Of course, they have to follow the historic preservation guidelines of a sloped roof and weathered shingles, all that stuff. I want you to look. See, now, when you go out to look for postmodern buildings, I'm not going to be there with my pointer, so you need to know what to look at. Here, look at this. This is what's called a Palladian window from classical buildings, you know, the arch top and the wider bottom. Well, what does, imagine a Palladian window in the hands of Robert Venturi. Oh, here's the homage to the older buildings. This is the Jared Coffin House. This is what all new buildings in Nantucket are supposed to look like. This is what Venturi does with the Palladian window. He puts the bathroom in the most sacred part of the window. So here you see in the section. I mean, that's absolutely shocking to do that. So that's the kind of stuff that he's into. And that's why you need me up here explaining why it's important. Right on time. Another thing I like to do with the students is to think about where these crazy ideas of postmodernism came from, because they certainly didn't just spring into the brain of Robert Venturi in the 1970s. And I really think that Disney architecture is a major, major source for the postmodern architects. Everybody's been to a Disney park, right? Well, Disney World or Disneyland. So you'll know that the use of scale in Disney architecture is really used to manipulate people. Control people. Everything from where you have to park, because there's some guy in a yellow and white shirt pointing, you know, that you have to park that way, or where you move, where you spend money, all of that stuff. And, of course, being at Disney is all about fantasy, and the manipulation of scale empowers people. It makes adults feel bigger, but, of course, it also makes kids feel really great that they are so big compared to the buildings. So the Disney parks, I think, are 1955 and 1971 in Anaheim and Orlando, respectively, and were originally an advertisement for the Disney movies, but then became a place in itself, really an instant success, just the way Williamsburg had been and the way the Vietnam Memorial is. So what in my class, I actually have a lecture just on Disney architecture, and all of it could be applied to postmodern buildings too. So I just want to run through a list of things that Disney architecture does to you, and you'll see it's transferable directly to postmodern architecture. The first thing we should say about Disney, the Disney worlds, is that there are clear, defined boundaries. You are either in or out. So you have to take, well, a car, and then a monorail, and then go through, and then get in a big lineup, and then pay $100 to get in, and then you're inside. So all of those filters make that threshold very clear. You can never be halfway into a Disney place, and of course, in a postmodern building, you can never be halfway. And either you're in it or you're not in it. The second thing is that it's related, is that there's this idea of filters, of different speeds of movement. You can take a train, you buy a ticket, you go on an axis. The architecture is the stage set for the event. The third is the idea of miniaturization. Every building at Disney is 7/8 scale. So it's almost the right size, but it's just a little bit small. So a doorway is 7/8 what a CMHC doorway would be. And as I said, this makes you feel very good, makes you feel in control. Of course, then you'll spend money and stay a long time. But it makes kids feel very big. And kids just love postmodern architecture, too. The fourth one is the idea of privileging consumption. Most postmodern places are all about shopping and eating, and there's very little else that you can do there. The museum will become the ultimate postmodern building typology. Places like Bilbao by Frank Gehry, and they are all about consumption, too. Now, the fifth one is that Disney architecture, the Disney world, has to be believable. That although you know you're in an imaginary place, you also know that you belong to this other real world. But the way that they make it seem a little bit believable is that the characters never speak. One of my classmates at Berkeley was a character, so I know all about how they train characters. And there's only one of each, like one Snow White or one Goofy on at any time, because it'd be terrible if you saw two Snow Whites, and that would just blow the whole dream. The sixth one is that technology and history are easily juxtaposed, that we don't mind at Disney seeing something high-tech like Tomorrowland next to Frontierland, which is supposed to bring us back to another time and place. And that, I think, leads to this very important postmodern idea, my seventh point from Disney, which is the idea of disconnectedness, that in a postmodern place, you're not supposed to experience it then and now. Most people video it or take photos on their cell phone and feel that part of the experience of the place is going home and seeing it again virtually. And so if you go to the Disney parks, 50% of people are either on the phone, as they are everywhere, but or are just walking with a video camera. And this disconnectedness, I think, is something that really marks life in the postmodern era. The experience, and this is the gate of Tomorrowland, the experience is really a collage, that you can jump from one era to the next. It doesn't bother us that the high-speed monorail goes right in front of the colonial-style city hall. That's okay, and that's true in postmodernism, too. And, of course, this play with scale. This is the new sports hotel at Disney, the cheapest place to stay, and it actually makes for a realm of continuous pleasure. This is certainly the inspiration for, not this hotel, but this idea is the inspiration for Venturi's Adoration of the Duck, and will lead right into our love of branding in the late 20th century, that, of course, the duck is really a brand. And we can enter these places. Here's Kodak. Coke was in the last one. This is the Bugs Life playground, where you're supposed to be playing, and those are big blades of grass, and you are tiny because the film canister is so small. You can enter it like the Vietnam Memorial. So these buildings share characteristics that are more to do with how they are experienced, I think, than how they look. You could never seriously put this beside the Vietnam Memorial and say that they look alike, but they are very, very close in ideas. So by the 1980s, we really see these ideas trickling down to everyday life, if that's what you want to call Rodeo Drive in Los Angeles. This is two Rodeo Drive that will certainly change the way shopping centers are designed across North America. Very upper-end mall. I mean, look at these cars. Is on a corner and gives the... It's a shopping street, but it gives the illusion of separate buildings. So all these buildings on this curved street were designed at once. They're each in different styles. They're all connected inside, just the way the Disney buildings are on Main Street. The street has a fake slope. This two-rate Rodeo Drive, I think, is the inspiration for places like Destrant or other of these malls that have appeared on the road that... there were farmers' fields there before, and now there are real streets. Well, you've seen them. Anyway, the other thing is that old malls, you know, like Yorkdale and Fairview and modernist 50s malls have all remade themselves according to this, like as if they've all put on pajamas. And they have, so Silver City looks like this, and, of course, Indigo looks like this, and the profile of the mall has just been changed in a very Venturi-esque way, so that each store has a different, branded architecture. Now, architects' houses become quite outrageous at this time because architects are so desperate to show their ideas, and usually they can only get their mothers to commission a house. So Robert Venturi's mother's house is actually one of the great icons of postmodernism. But I wanted to show you this even more outrageous house. This was a modest post-war bungalow in Richmond, California, which is, mostly a Navy base. It's a very, very modest place. So the architect Thomas Gordon Smith just exploded it and for himself and turned it into this kind of Pompeian villa. And what he does, this is his living room on the left, and architecture students see it. Oh, it's so hard to see. It's a Pompeian ceiling, and in paying homage to the local industry, which is the petroleum industry, Exxon, he's made a Petrolia, the fake Roman goddess of gas, and then put all these gas stations around the ceiling decoration. It's supposed to be funny and ironic, and to me it's just very much like the Bugs Life playground. There's no question. We see this in very high-style buildings, too. This is Philip Johnson's AT&T building, certainly the most famous postmodern skyscraper. It's right in Manhattan, 1984. It, of course, is just an ordinary-looking skyscraper, except that the top of it looks like a Chippendale chair. So it's a play with scale, because a chair is much smaller than an office building. Vancouver has a library that looks like a coliseum, that's very much along the same spirit. These are imaginary places. They are tricks. Often they are very elegant. Certainly the library and the AT&T building are. But what you really must appreciate is the change in focus. And with both Moshe Safdie, the architect of the Vancouver Library, and Philip Johnson, who's shown here as a young man without his signature round glasses, and I include this photo because that's his iconic glass house, his own house from 1949 in the back. Imagine the change in focus that's occurred for him personally, going from being a groupie of Mies van der Rohe, where he designs only glass and steel buildings, to designing a skyscraper for AT&T that looks like a Chippendale chair. And the comparison with Safdie is that they both had such long and productive careers that we can see them move from being a modernist to a postmodernist within the same office, which is a really, really interesting phenomenon. Now, the trickle down for most of us, sadly, have been these horrible buildings. And so this is one in Vancouver on the left, and this is one I just took my daughter took last weekend. She's 10. In a moving car on the 401 in Toronto. And the tops of the buildings are just ridiculous. They're just, you know, cheap standard buildings with these funky tops on them. And it is a way of branding the building. They get old-looking very fast. I won't name any of the Montreal examples in case any of you live in them. But I think you know them. Anyway, it's a... That's what happens when these ideas trickle down for a long time. This is one of the best architects' own house examples. This is Frank Gehry's own house in Santa Monica from 1978, exactly this time period. It's been called cheapskate architecture, also called punk. I mean, you all know about Frank Gehry because his career has taken off like a meteor, and he's got this Canadian background, so we especially love him here. But here in his own house where he still lives, you can see he uses very irreverent shapes and materials. The house itself is mostly covered in chicken wire like we use to keep children into playgrounds or to protect construction sites. So an inside is a 1920s just ordinary bungalow, the same, a little nicer than Thomas Gordon Smith's was, but still a pretty ordinary place. So Las Vegas, L.A., I think, is for Gehry what Las Vegas was for Venturi. And all these buildings have become real spectacles for architects. So here I have a picture of McGill architecture students who I went to see the house with. And Frank Gehry actually came outside and asked if we wanted Coke and popcorn while we looked at his house. So it just seemed perfectly apt that he did that. And so he did let us go, he didn't invite us in, but he did let us go right up and look through the window. So I took these James Bond spy photos. And see, this is the old part of the house. Well, this is the problem being tethered to the table. Here is the old exterior wall, and this is the part that he's added, which kind of looks like an architect's office. Now I have a couple more things to show you. Oh, and there's the great chicken wire. Beautiful, don't you think? So the architectural process, as I'm sure you're getting, becomes very, very personal at this time and is a real signature feature for these architects. It's definitely part of the selling point of a building. Michael Graves from Princeton added playfulness and warmth to postmodernism. This is one of his great drawings for the Fargo-Moorhead Bridge that I don't think was ever built. But when I was in school in the 1980s, we all tried to draw like this. It was like a cult to draw like Michael Graves, and we all wanted this bright yellow sketch paper that you could only order from Charette, this store in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And we ordered it just by the mile because the Prismacolor pencil looked so nice. It just jumped out of it, and we all learned to color this way and then to color that way so that you could see the layers. Anyway, that, too, is a very, very postmodern process. Very whimsical, and his buildings actually look like cartoons. It was his building on the front of the Jenks book. I had an opportunity as a student. I won this great thing where I just got to travel for a year, and one of the things I got to do was go to Leningrad with a whole bunch of other American architectural students. So I traveled with Michael Graves. He was like our hero, and here's a bunch of students I was with. And so we were out every day drawing with him, which was, you know, one of the highlights of my professional life. And I got to watch him do these cartoonish drawings. And so I can say with certainty that he puts things in his drawings that are not there, and that we all tried to draw just like him. And this is just before the CAD revolution, you know, where everybody uses computers for design. It's really this moment when the hand drawing becomes so important. And so he did this drawing for me at the Russian border. We were stuck there for about 8 hours on a bus while they, you know, shone lights on us and looked underneath. And so you can see he wrote for A.M. Michael Graves at the border. And I wanted to show it to you because it's one of my most precious objects. in my office, but also because this was the kind of stuff he drew. This is the Russian border. So I can assure you, there was no pyramid or any of these other things he drew. He just has this amazing imagination and this vocabulary that he just puts in all his drawings. So I've been a Michael Graves watcher ever since then because I felt this personal connection to him. So when his Clopegas Winery in California opened, I turned to my own sketchbook of Leningrad, and I'm pretty sure that he probably used his sketch of that building to design the winery. So these kinds of historical associations, I think, are very, very important. Of course, in a modern building, you would never do that. You would never directly reference an older building, and certainly not a building in Leningrad. Now, you might know Michael Graves best through his iconic tea kettle from 1985 that he designed for Alessi, the Italian kitchenware company. It's very famous. Lots of architects have it, that's for sure. And it, too, is a postmodern object. The color palette of the maroon and the beautiful blue. But also, it's very Venturi-esque, wouldn't you think, in the fact that he puts a bird where the whistle comes out. So it's almost like a duck in that way. Now, the really dumb thing, and there's always a dumb thing, is that you have to, in order to pour, you have to take the bird out, and so you burn your hands. So, because you take it out at the point of boiling. My husband, who loves to point out all the dumb things architects design, having been dragged around the world for 20 years with me looking at postmodern buildings, claims that, you know, that's part of the experience, that the chair is supposed to make you uncomfortable, and the tea kettle is supposed to burn you. Anyway, I have to add that because I think that's a very good insight. So to wrap up, I think this is what we've seen in our tour of postmodern architecture. If we were going to have a quiz, which we can, this is the kind of thing that I would want you to repeat in the exam, that it's a style that's about being after modernism, that it's a critique of modernism, that it's imaginary and fantasy-based. It's about imagining a different past or a different world, and that brings a lot of pleasure to a lot of people. There's a playfulness to it. We see that in Venturi and Geary and Michael Graves and lots of other places. That we don't see that playfulness in the generic imitations of those guys. That's what is missing in the, you know, the building on the 401. And the user experience becomes very important. Modernism was a universal solution to something, and postmodernism really is a personal solution. People's emotions are acknowledged, I think, most beautifully in Maya Lin's memorial. The symbolic, iconic sense of place we see, in Disney architecture, in Johnson's AT&T building, and lots of other examples, lots of references to history, glorification of the everyday. I sense that you didn't think the Guildhouse was a great masterpiece, but it did make architects sit up and think about what is around them in North American cities. Technology, of course, is at the basis of much of late postmodernism. Certainly Geary's very expensive museum work would not be possible without the computer technology that comes right out of the aerospace industry and other high-tech industries. Complexity over simplicity. I forgot to say that one of the things Venturi loves is that things can be seen in different ways. He calls them an and-or situation. The building should be able to be interpreted that way. So the Guildhouse can just be an invisible, unremarkable building, or it can be a very smart statement on how we treat our older generation. Humor, irony, scale to manipulate, I think, come directly from Disney. Consumption and exclusivity we see most obviously in shopping environments, so places like... Well, one of the things I study in my hospital's book is the Atrium Hospital. So, like Sick Kids in Toronto or the Walter Mackenzie Hospital in Edmonton, these hospitals that actually look like malls are very postmodern places. And what I'm interested is in terms of looking at this trickle-down theory, is that everything starts to look like the mall. The library, the airport, the university, it's called atriumitis in my class. And it's fooling people. It's fooling people into spending money in many cases, because I think what we do is we walk a certain way in mall. I can't believe I'm adding this. We walk a certain way in mall architecture. I call it the mall crawl, where we just get into this kind of mode of spending money. And so when we're in the hospital or the airport like that, of course, it has very, very different connotations. Disconnectedness and filtering, we all go home and go on the internet, which is a very, very isolating thing, and I worry a lot about students studying buildings that way. The house and the museum become the showcase. The buildings I didn't talk about, there's a very reactionary, very conservative strain of postmodernism associated with neoclassicism, people like Robert Stern, and I think Philip Johnson goes that way too, where there is this suggestion that the buildings are superior because they are neoclassical. Peter Eisenman is speaking here Monday night. If any of you are still here, it'll be the biggest lecture of our season. I'm sure there'll be thousands of people. And he would be a really good example of a more elitist type of postmodern architecture that's very, very difficult to understand. It's so theoretical. Process becomes important, and of course signature architects turn into starchitects in the postmodern building. I'll leave these this summary of the lecture on while during the question period. I just want to end by saying that I think it was a really fascinating period in architecture, and I'm really glad it's over. Thank you very much. Alex, yeah.
I have a question. Like I said, I'm a big fan of architecture. So what was your take on some of these more modern, more recent, if you call them, architects, someone like Norman Foster, with his Gecko building in London, some of you may know, or more recently, the Hearst Tower in New York. Would that quantify it as going down with the postmodern?
Yeah, no, I think that people, the high-tech architects, like Richard Rogers, too, or Norman Foster, really were never real postmodernists. They followed this road of high modernism, this exaggerated modernism that's really quite different. So more like the Pompidou Center.
Okay, but I sense it's a more... Pompidou Center is a bit of an extreme example, but I personally find the Hearst Tower in New York a very elegant building. It's a couple of curtains
out there. Yeah, no, I think many of these are elegant buildings. I didn't mean to say they weren't elegant.
Well, the example of the Pompidou Center.
Yeah, no, I meant that... Foster certainly continued to push this very high-tech aesthetic and didn't really go in. I mean, he certainly is not interested in historical allusions or neoclassicism. Yes?
An American journalist once asked Pete Vanderloh how he could reconcile the idealism of the Bauhaus with the sterility of modern architecture. And he sarcastically answered, the buildings were designed in order to control unruly children. If we then go to postmodernism, we seem to mention this. If we get to contemporary architecture, there are a couple of Swiss architects, for example, whose name escapes me at the moment, but apparently they're well known, who've added the tactile sense to the building, believing that buildings should be touched on the outside, and they've done all kinds of fancy materials. Very interestingly enough, they spend so much money doing the outside of the building that they usually ran short of money, and so the inside of the buildings are often unfinished. So
that's probably Herzog and Deburon. Right.
So we now seem to have gone from childhood to rebellious, playful adolescence. So my question, therefore, is, are we going to reach maturity, and how would we define it?
I wish I had a crystal ball, but I have no idea. I mean, what's current today is a very kind of serious return to modernism. that's, you know, skips over the postmodern era for sure. These buildings are very easy to date and to get distanced from. So like the Schulich School of Music would be a very fine example of the kind of architecture that's very current today in the magazines. Very slick, very high-tech, very elegant in its use of materials. But what do you think is going to happen?
I don't know. I mean, you're the architect.
Yeah. Luckily, I'm a historian and not a futurist. Yes. Well, Arthur Erickson really remained a modernist throughout his career. And, as you know, his career just ended. So, I guess there are a few examples of late neoclassical buildings. But I admire his buildings very much. Yes?
I was fascinated to hear that you're an expert on gendered spaces.
Yes.
It sounds to me as if you're an expert in toilets.
It is. My nickname in graduate school was Ms. Drainage. You're right. I am an expert in toilets.
That's the new expression for toilets. Gendered space.
No, not at all. No, everything is gendered space. Bathrooms are only extreme examples and easy to read. But absolutely everything that is designed has gender implications. So in my class, we look at different typologies. Every week, we look at a different one. We started looking at the post-war house for the nuclear family. Then we looked at bachelor pads designed by Playboy magazine. And then we've moved on to same-sex architecture, and we had a tour of McGill dormitories. Well, we went to the Royal Victoria College and then the nurse's residence at the Royal Victoria Hospital. And we're looking at gendered practices in architectural education this week. Way beyond the toilet.
This was on the topic of public buildings. Why is it? Is it because more men are architects of some of these large buildings? Here's a good example. A Bond Theatre in Stratford, Ontario was redesigned about 8 or 9 years ago, and the toilets were put in the basement, and they're the same space. So when you go down there and you see the lineups, you always know where the women are. I mean, there's a disproportionate. It seems to me there's no logic building a public building to make precisely exactly the same amount of space in men's facilities and women's. And yet, that lesson, I have never really seen it learned.
No, I think in the building code there is some provision for more women's toilets, but since it generally takes longer for women. That is the bottom line. It is, yeah. No, if you go to the Bell Center, it's just so obvious and on the break that women don't have a chance to get in there.
Right, so why isn't it changed? Why isn't the code changed?
We've got to get working on that.
Yeah.
Oh, architects do work on the code, for sure. But it's
no, but if it's user, it's supposed to be user experience. You know, it just seems ridiculous that we haven't come up with a system that works better.
Well, I think
but
the real problem...
more proactive in this...
Well, that's a big problem in architecture. Women are approximately 19% of the profession, and the students have been, we've had a majority women students since 1980. Actually, this year we have something like 66% women in the incoming class. But something happens between graduation and registration, and a lot of women leave, maybe because it's quite an unfriendly profession for women. But I don't think that's really the toilet problem, but it's a larger problem in the profession for sure. Yes.
Well, I had a couple of comments. One is I appreciated your talk very much.
Thank you.
Two, there is a twin to the Vancouver Library in Salt Lake City.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had a question about the first two names of this architect that was born in Richmond. And the last question is, was the building in Leningrad or now Petersburg the Admiralty? I couldn't really identify.
I don't really remember what it was because I just drew it. It probably was the Admiralty, and the architect's name is Thomas Gordon Smith. Thomas Gordon Smith. It's a triple name. You see, part of being a postmodern architect is you can't have the name Tom Smith. you got to have a much more embellished name, and it starts with Frank Lloyd Wright, who would have been, you know, Frank Wright. So, yes. 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 Okay, by Richard Meyer. Everybody knows it. One of the most expensive building projects of the late 20th century, and certainly one of the great icons of the museum designed by Starkitect. I would not consider it postmodern in its appearance. The only postmodern thing that has occurred to me about it, I've been there many times, is that idea of leaving your car and getting on the monorail to go up the hill. It's very much like Disney and like these places. Although the difference is there's not a steep admission price, but there feels like there should be. I mean, everybody in there is saying, I can't believe that it doesn't cost a lot to come. So you leave your stuff behind, you get on this monorail, you're on it for, I don't know, 2 minutes, and then you're in this other realm that feels like an imaginary place. The buildings themselves are quite modernist, although unlike other buildings by Richard Meyer, and he uses this signature white tile, all his buildings are very slick and white, he used this specially cut travertine marble that was brought there, and it's just a fortune. And so it doesn't shine, it doesn't glow like a Richard Meyer building does, but otherwise it's very much like a Meyer experience, and the interiors are unremarkable. In the villa, you mean, or? I can't comment on it. What do you think of it? Uh-huh.
It'd be nice to see the statuary in place, you know, in context. But
it's still in Mr. Getty's home, though, yes. Yeah. Yes. No, I think Prince Charles is a very unpopular guy with architects. I think many of his comments were really ill-informed, and that he did a lot of damage. Well, you know, calling the Venturi's National Gallery, I believe it was, a carbuncle, or was that right? I might not have the association right, but... I don't really think he ever understood postmodernism, and then he started this very right-wing school of architecture, hired some of my former colleagues even to work there, and then it just completely fizzled out, as I understand it's completely dead. So it's too bad that such a prominent public figure would discourage people, I think, from really understanding 20th century buildings. I hope I didn't take too long. I had so many warnings. Thank you very much.
Okay, well, Professor Adams, thank you very much for a most interesting lecture. I mean, I personally have a great interest in it, very enlightening. So on behalf of the Alumni Association,
thank you very much.
Just to remind everyone that there's homecoming is far from over. There's a lot of stuff going on. There is a reception in the main lobby of the arts building at 5:30 if you're willing to wander around and mingle. Lots of fun and goodies. There will not be fine champagne. I insisted they had fine champagne, but, you know, we had a budget.
That's next year.
But there'll still be some good wine and lots of fun nibbles, so please feel free to stick around. And lots of activities tomorrow, so hopefully we'll see you around soon. Thank you very much.
Thank you.